All right. Welcome to another episode of the Superior Man Podcast. I am joined here with Dr. Michael. How do I say your last name? Praciter?
No, Pariser.
Pariser. And you were introduced to me by Dr. Glover, which we hopped on a podcast with him as well. And I really, really wanted to go over a lot of stuff that I actually read through your book a little bit and actually went through some of the exercises to see how someone who is a nice guy, someone who is trying to recover from their nice guy syndrome, can take practical steps to do so, especially in today's world and what's going on. So before we get started, for everyone who doesn't know who you are, can you just give us a little bit of a quick intro, who you are, what you do, and how you came about your journey?
Sure. My name is Dr. Michael Pariser. I'm a psychotherapist in Los Angeles, California, and I've been a psychotherapist for the past 20 years. Like a lot of psychotherapists, I view myself as a wounded healer, that I'm walking a path that a lot of other people have walked in the past, and a lot of other people will walk in the future. It's the path of recovering from, I want to call it fucked up childhood syndrome, which is something we all have. And so maybe being a little bit more emotionally sensitive than my brother and sisters, I felt kind of the pain of it more. And so throughout my life, that's caused me problems, because the things that I did to make up for the pain that I had often created interpersonal problems and personal problems. So I was depressed for a while, and I had relationships that didn't work. And I tried to kind of deal with them all by becoming a nice guy, by making other people happy, by putting other people first, and by kind of living a life of selflessness. But it was a dishonest life, because I got negated, my sense of self got obliterated in the process. And so I wound up struggling to make things work, and never did. And I went into therapy, and that helped. And I had a couple of different therapists, and things got better. But it seemed like I had this kind of constellation of problems that I could never solve one without the other one. It's like emotional whack-a-mole. And what I wound up thinking is, boy, I will never, it's like a swarm of bees, right? How do you deal with a swarm of bees? Well, you can't deal with a swarm of bees one at a time. It just doesn't work. So one day, and I was like so frustrated, I was dating and my last relationship hadn't worked, and I was just kind of depressed and maddened about the whole thing. And I thought, how come all these other guys can get these beautiful women and like have all these relationships can we need to hold off just one second? I apologize.
No worries. That's a good example of setting standards right there.
Right.
Yeah.
I live on a boat in Marina Del Rey, California. And I normally drive the boat pretty well, because I've been living on it for 5 or 6 years. But about a month ago, I was backing it into my slip, and the wind took it and it moved it at an angle. And as I backed it up, I bumped into the dock with the swim step, which broke. And now I've got a couple of guys fixing the swim step. And so they showed up right as we were talking. So
no worries. Let's continue from where we left off.
Yeah. Okay. So what I was saying was this. You can't fight a swarm of bees one at a time. You have to deal with the hive. And I didn't know what the hive was. And one day I was kind of working. I was like frustrated because I was trying to kind of work through my problems. And also I was trying to date successfully and it wasn't working. And in my frustration, I thought, okay, I'm going to go on Amazon, and I've never done this before. Like all these books about like how to pick up girls and how to get laid and how to like be a badass and like get the women you've always like. And I thought, is this really me? Have I really sunk to this level? And the answer was yes, I had really sunk to this level. And so one of the books that I bought that day was No More Mr. Nice Guy, which I thought was going to be something like, you know, how to pick up girls and get laid by being, you know, the bad boy, not the nice guy. And it turns out, of course, since you've read the book and talked to Dr. Glover, you know that's not what it's about at all. It's about not being a nice guy, but not being an asshole either. It's about being an honest, direct, authentic, assertive, and integrated male, someone who embodies healthy masculinity rather than toxic masculinity. And so when I read that book, and for all the guys out there who haven't read it, I really recommend it. And what it does is it just nails this syndrome. It just describes it to a T. And a lot of guys, myself included, who have read it, we all have the same experience. It's like, oh my God, this guy was like following me around, taking notes on how to live life badly. All of a sudden, the hive of bees came together. All of a sudden, things made sense because it didn't seem like a kind of, you know, 1,000 little problems. It now started to seem like one big problem. And that now made more sense. And by kind of keeping the central issue in mind, I was able to begin to make progress where I hadn't made it before. So over the course of, that was back in 2012. And since then, I've been doing that work for myself and I've been doing it with Dr. Glover. He sometimes comes to Los Angeles and we do workshops together. And I've been doing it for guys in my practice. I have a monthly workshop. I have a couple of associates running groups and doing individual therapy. And a theme emerged, an issue that a lot of the recovering nice guys were having, which is, okay, we read Dr. Glover's book. It makes perfect sense. It's me. So what do I do? And Dr. Glover, you know, in his book, he keeps kind of, he says it overtly, but I don't think he says it with the force that he really means it, which is get a therapist, which is as a therapist, I'm really happy when guys want to get a therapist, right?
Right.
But not everybody has access to good psychotherapy. I mean, you live in Toronto. There's wonderful psychotherapists in Toronto. I'm in Los Angeles. Great. But what if you live in, you know, Rapid City, South Dakota, or Ames, Iowa? Are there good therapists? Are there people who know what the nice guy syndrome is? And so I said to Robert Glover, I said, you know, you need to write a workbook to go along with your book. And he said to me, I don't want to. So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll write it with you. And he said, I don't want to. You write it. So that's what I did. It started out as a workbook, but as you've looked at it, there's more to it. There's a lot of stuff coming from my own work with men, my own experience as a recovering nice guy, and my own life experience and psychotherapy work, and kind of all of that's in there, matching Dr. Glover's book kind of chapter by chapter with some other stuff, and then kind of co-structured using Joseph Campbell's idea of the hero's journey. So you're going to go on a journey of recovery from nice guy syndrome. And the book is called No More Mr. Nice Guy, The Hero's Journey, A Step-by-Step Guide to Becoming an Integrated Male. And that's kind of the basic story.
Right. And I've been looking through the book. I had a few questions, obviously. I mean, I haven't gone through the entire thing because in the introduction, I believe it was in the introduction or the preface, how you wrote, every person should be going through these things one chapter per week or one chapter per month to make sure that you're actually utilizing everything. And I really wanted to utilize this book because I remember myself reading Dr. Glover's book and same problem. It was like, this is me. Like, this is me to a T, but what do I do now? You know, like, how do I actually overcome this? So I was just wondering, I kind of went through the exercises a little bit, kind of did an overview, and there was just so many exercises. This book is a true workbook that you have to actually sit down and think and go through and really put your heart into it. How did these exercises come about? Was it just from therapy? Was it something that you learned from Dr. Robert Glover? Or was it a mixture of your own experiences, your own therapy that you went through, et cetera?
It's my own experience. You know, I think in Dr. Glover's, can I have a sandwich too?
It's not a sandwich. He was making a steak, so.
Fantastic. In his book, he has what are called breaking free activities, and he's got about 30 of them. But they didn't seem, they're not really well fleshed out. And so I thought, you know, I can use some of those. Then I can use some of what I've done with my patients in my private practice, and I could do some of what I've done in kind of in group work and in workshops. And little by little, I just created them. And so almost all of them are just straight from me, although where they match Dr. Glover's breaking free activities, I've indicated that in the book. And yeah, I want to make a point, which is, this is not a read the book and change your life in 30 days book. And anybody who's looking to do that, it's the wrong book for you. This is a book that's going to take you on a journey. And a journey is not a short thing. Jason and the Argonauts didn't go out for the weekend. They went on a quest. And you're going to go, if you read this book and you follow it, you will go on a quest too. Ultimately, the quest will last your entire life, because what I've put in there is about psychological growth. And psychological growth is a nonstop process. You never stop growing. You know, he not busy being born is busy dying. Bob Dylan said that. I take it seriously. So I've been trying to grow all my life. I'm still trying to grow, and I'm 69 years old. So I'm not going to stop. And I recommend to you that you don't stop either.
Right. So this is which is what I wanted to ask you next. Is like all the stuff surrounding the nice guy syndrome, surrounding overcoming the nice guy syndrome. Do you think it's a lifelong journey and something that you're going to have to work on for the rest of your life to really become the best person that you can be? Or is it something that you can truly overcome and in a year or 2 years you've overcome it, and then from there your life really grows?
So I would say yes, both. That's not, it turns out to be not either or. It's more like, I want to introduce the idea of a learning curve. And when you have a learning curve, a lot of the learning takes place in the beginning. If you're learning to play tennis, or you're learning to play golf, or you're learning martial arts, or you're learning yoga, whatever, you're learning a new language, there's going to be a lot of learning in the beginning. And so that's the first year or two that you're talking about. But at the same time, the process never stops. And so you're going to keep learning. You might learn at a slower pace, or you might learn finer points once you've grasped the basics, but the learning never stops, because nobody's perfect. You never get to be perfect. And you can always be challenged by new things, and I hope you are. And every new situation that you go into will challenge you in ways, some old ways and some new ways. And hopefully what you've learned will help you so that you don't fall back into the same kind of junk that you did before. But you can always be triggered, so you always have to keep learning.
That's interesting that you say to always challenge yourself, because I feel like a lot of guys who follow me are almost in this pitfall in their life where they're not challenged at all whatsoever. They're kind of going through this lull. And it's like the old quote, most men die at the age of 25. They just wait till they're 75 to make it official. Uh-huh. And so I wanted to ask you, like, for the guy who has zero challenges in his life, he's going through almost this lull in his life. Everything's just a routine. He's pretty much spiritually dead. What would you recommend to him? Would you recommend him to go on this nice guy journey to figure out all these things? Or would you recommend them to just start challenging himself to do other things in his life? Because I feel like the nice guy syndrome is also very directly correlated with men who just don't take risks or do the things that they actually want to in their life. So what would you recommend for the guy who has zero challenge in his life whatsoever? He's not even at a point where he's not even feeling challenged, because he's just going through life and going through the motions and what's kind of given to him. He's settling.
Mm-hmm. So, those aren't mutually exclusive. So, going on a nice guy's journey and or challenging yourself in other ways, those aren't mutually exclusive. You can do both, and I recommend that you do both. In fact, what I recommend is, go and get a t-shirt and on it, or put on your mirror, or safety is overrated. Safety, the stagnation is coming from a fall into security. So these are security operations in action. And what guys are doing, they don't realize it. It's easier. Yeah, okay, it's easier. And maybe there's nothing wrong with easiness, but they don't recognize that behind the ease and behind the stability and security is something like fear. And it's fear of something. What would happen? And this is a question that if I were doing psychotherapy with one of the men that you're talking about, I would say, so what's so great about being stuck in a rut? What's so wonderful about you know, being unable to move? What's so great about nothing new? And then they'll go, oh, no, there's nothing great about it. And I would say, no, that's not true. Because if it wasn't so great, you wouldn't be there. And I've seen the brochure, and it doesn't look so good. So what are you doing down in that rut? And then they go, oh, they start, well, what are you afraid might happen if you start to do different things? If the pieces of your life didn't kind of glue together the way that they do right now, what would that be like for you? And then you hear this other defensive stuff. Oh, it would be so wonderful. Yeah, no, no, it wouldn't. No, because if it were so wonderful, you would have done it years ago. So there's something terrible. There's some psychological catastrophe that you're afraid awaits you around the corner. And the question is, what is it? And so we start now to move into kind of their personal darkness. Hold on, let me just close this because the guys who are working on the swim step are now using power tools. So hang on, just
I can't hear it too much.
Oh, good, that's good.
I'm just wondering, like, one of the biggest
By the way, do you edit the podcast, or do people get to watch you eat and hear me talk about the power drills?
Well, I paused the recording, but right now it's recording. Okay. I like to keep it very raw. I like to keep it very real because it is a conversation at the end of the day. So I like to throw it out there.
So this is a little bonus for everybody out there. You get to watch Mo eat salad. It's great.
Steak and salad. It's a mixture.
Steak and salad. Nice.
Right. So I'm just wondering, because you mentioned you went through therapy, and recently I've personally gotten a therapist myself a month ago, because I realized, especially with what's going on with the quarantine, you're really faced with your inner demons. You really start to realize all the things that you were doing before were almost mere distractions to you not facing your inner thoughts and inner patterns. So when searching for a therapist, when someone is reading this book, goes through the workbook and says, you know what, I want a therapist, I want someone to work with, what should they search for in terms of searching for a quality therapist? Is it just someone that they connect with, or does the therapist actually have to have some training in this, you know, nice guy syndrome stuff to really help them?
That's a good question. Up until I read this, I mean, if you want to work on a specific issue, your therapist ought to be familiar with the issue. And but you may not have that choice. The good news is that, you know, Dr. Glover's book could be read in 3 hours. And so you could bring the book, you could say to a therapist, look, I'm considering working with you. This is what I'm working with. Would you be willing to read this book if we work together? Would you be willing to read it? And can we work on these issues specifically? And I don't know any therapist who's going to say no. They'll all say yes. There might be some kind of hard-ass exceptions, but as a rule, no, they'll all read it. So, in more general terms about finding a good psychotherapist, yes, someone who you get along with, but not too well. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you don't want your psychotherapy to be a repetition of the safety operations that you're already running. So you don't want somebody who's just nice and kind and agrees with everything that you say. You want somebody who is also challenging. Just like you want to be challenged in life, you want to be challenged in psychotherapy. Psychotherapy is kind of life condensed into an hour. And so what you want is somebody who's going to ask you questions nobody ever asked you before. Questions you don't have answers to. So when I ask my patients questions, oftentimes they'll say, I don't know. And that's good. If they knew, it would be a bad question. And what I often tell them is, I'm not looking for answers like, I'm not asking you what is the capital of Delaware. I'm looking for, the questions I ask are invitations to exploration. So when a therapist asks you a question that doesn't have an answer like, you know, the capital of Delaware is Dover, it has answers like, gee, I don't know, I never thought about that before. That's intriguing. And your mind, you can see your head going like, and your mind is going like tilt, you know, I'm someplace I've never been before. That's a good therapist. That's right. One you want to keep.
So someone who basically invites you to explore things that you basically never explored before.
Right. Because if you go where you've already gone, what will you learn?
Right. That makes sense.
You have to go someplace new if you want to learn.
That makes total sense. So there was something in your book that I was curious about, because I was going through the exercises, and one of the questions was, in your family, you know, what role did you play to create stability or create harmony within the role of the family to make sure that it's stable? And that question was really hard for me to answer because, you know, personally for me growing up, there wasn't any stability in my family. There wasn't any harmony, so to speak. It was very chaotic. And so thinking about that, I was going through the question and I couldn't answer it because I was like, well, there was no part of my role that created stability. So what would you tell the guy, someone like me, who maybe is going through the book and has questions that he comes up with that he can't answer because it may not apply to him, quote unquote?
So that's an intriguing question. So one of the things that I would say is, there, just as you've done, you have to do some thinking about it. And oftentimes it comes in disguised form. And so you have to kind of start to pull it apart. And so I would say, of course, the first thing I would say is keep looking. It doesn't always, it's not like I was a wonderful child and I took care of everybody and I washed the dishes and I took out the garbage and I walked the dog so nobody would have to. And I mean, in my particular case, I was a problem. I made lots of bad jokes and I rebelled against the family and against my mother, and I grew my hair long and I started to, like, I was a problem. And so there was unity in the family about what to do about Michael. So in a negative way, I helped create stability in the family. Now in your case, I would have to like have a dialogue, and we could try it for a couple of minutes and see if we go somewhere. And then I want to just kind of throw in a thought. You know something? Look, my book is full of exercises. It's not about getting 100 points on every single one, because there are none with 100 points. So it's about doing them the best you can and learning from them and growing from them and using what you get, not necessarily to pass a test. So in your family where there was chaos, if we want to think about it, chaos is stable. In other words, that was the norm. Whatever was the norm is the stable thing, even if it looks chaotic on the surface.
So stability doesn't mean a good thing. It doesn't have to be a positive thing.
Right. A, it doesn't have to be a positive. B, do you want to let him out?
Yeah, I'll let the dog out. Come here. I guess she doesn't want to go out anymore. So
she can't. So stability just means sameness. If you're at war, the state of war is stable. If your family is chaotic, the state of chaos is stable. That sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it's not. All I mean by stability in this sense is the norm for your family. And so then you can ask yourself, who are you in the chaos? Are you the center of solidity and stability? Are you the instigator? Are you the catalyst? Are you the comforter? Who are you in that system?
Could it be possible that you're a mixture of multiple?
Sure.
It could be multiple. Because there was times where, even for myself, like just thinking, there was times where I instigated and I was the troublemaker. And there was also times where I almost felt like within my family, I was the connector between everybody. Where mm-hmm. if there was a fight, I was the one who they would both connect with, so everybody would connect with. So it was almost like I was a mixture where I was causing trouble, but there was times where I was also connecting everyone.
It makes me wonder, and of course I don't know your background, but it makes me wonder if you could play two roles, and one of them, when you helped create kind of stability in the sense of everybody's together and united, but if they're two together and two united, then there's no, it's anxiety provoking. When will the other shoe drop? And so you actually go and drop the shoe, and then we're back where we started again. And now you can go switch back to your other role, which is the uniter. So if you're the uniter, you have no role unless there's war going on.
Right.
So if there is no war, you'll create it.
Right. And that's what it was like with a lot of my family. That's 100% true.
Well, there's the answer to the question. That makes a lot of sense. That's how you get there.
That's perfect. I wanted personal clarity for myself because I was going through. Okay. So what do you suggest to the nice guy? Because even for myself, again, just personal examples, there's times where I catch myself doing things where I don't want to. And this is something I've talked with my therapist where I've said, you know, I've had an emotional outburst, or I got angry. And afterwards I start to think, well, that wasn't me. That was really odd. So for the nice guy who sees himself constantly reverting back to behaviors that he notices as toxic or that he doesn't want in his life, what would you suggest to him should be the next step so that he can have less of those?
Well, I have two answers that come to my mind. The first one is comes from your statement, that's not me. So the first thing is to recognize, oh, yes, it is. It's not who you normally are, but it certainly is you. So then you have to look at what is it that triggers the emergence of these kind of separated. It's like I've got my ugly cousin in the closet, and he comes out like when things kind of get crazy, he comes out and starts wailing on people. So what's actually most helpful, here's a metaphor, is an analogy that I like to use. Imagine you're making hot chocolate, right? And you have a pot, you got the lid, right? And you put the milk in there and you're heating the milk for the hot chocolate. And you walk away, and of course, what happens? The thing blows up. Okay, so this is like you kind of getting angry at somebody else. You're not a boiling, raging pot. You are milk, right? you identify as milk, but there's a couple of other elements, which are the heat and the pot. And the pot has the pot part and the lid part. What is the biggest problem in that whole system? You got any idea? You want to take a guess?
The biggest problem in the whole system would be the heat.
No, because you can't avoid heat in life.
Oh, that's true.
You need the pot to put the milk in, and you need the milk for the hot chocolate. The problem is the lid. Why is the lid the problem? Because most lids are solid, right? You can't see when the milk is starting to boil.
Mm.
So if you have a glass lid, or you didn't, or you took the lid off, you could actually see when it starts to simmer, and you could turn the heat down before the milk boils over. So now let me translate that into life terms, okay? The milk is your emotional, level of emotional arousal, how upset or calm you are. Cold milk is very calm, right? The pot is the context of your life. It's you, right? The heat is what the external environment is doing to you. Your girlfriend is complaining all the time. Your boss is nagging or yelling. There's too much work. The dog is starting to lose it and pee on the carpet every day. Like whatever your whatever the situation. I'm trying to bring it home here. That's what you can't control. You can't control necessarily the heat, but what you can control, I mean, you can control it to a certain extent. But what you can do is, as you notice the milk is heating up, which is to say, as you notice that you're becoming more upset, you can take the pot off the heat. You can have a conversation with your wife. You could take the dog to the vet. You can have a sit down with the boss or go to HR or quit your job and get another job. You can do something before you blow up. And that's the key. The key is to notice when you're, the reason things are blowing up is you're not paying attention to the fact that you're getting upset. Or if you're aware of it, you're pushing it away and saying, no, I need to make this not happen. And so the goal is actually, it seems counterintuitive, but it's to become more aware of how upset you're getting, not less. Because if you can become more aware, you can become more sensitive to it at a lower level, and then you can do something before it becomes an explosion.
That just blew my fucking mind. I'm not gonna lie. That's where I'm just trying to see your brain right now. How do you come up with analogies? Because during this call, you've come up with so many different analogies, so many different quotes. Is there maybe quotes or analogies that you live by? Because just by you explaining that, I can see how that's going to benefit me. I could see how the next time I start to notice the milk boiling up, oh, what's going on? Let's take a look. Let's take the lid off and see where that comes from. So where did those analogies come from? Was it just from your personal experience?
You know, it is. It's just from my personal experience and from living a long time and from doing psychotherapy with a lot of people. They bring in analogies and I go, oh yeah, that's a useful one. Or what happens to me is there's a concept in psychotherapy or in psychoanalysis called reverie. And it's the idea that while you're talking to me, and let's say I'm your therapist and you're talking to me, it's not that I'm not listening. I am listening. But I'm listening with my outer ears, and with my inner ear, I'm listening to my own thoughts and feelings. And it takes a good number of years of experience to be able to do this effectively. Most young therapists, they're so eager to like pay attention to you that they stay surfacey. But as you get more experience, you can listen and at the same time kind of like look at what's going on your mental screen or your listen to the voices, and stuff starts bubbling up. Like, and I what I've learned to do is to pay attention to what bubbles up. In again, when I first started as a therapist, I would push it away. Oh, I can't think. I got to pay attention to my patient. I can't think these are irrelevant thoughts. Now I think, oh, this is really relevant. I don't even know how it's relevant, but I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to talk about it because I know it's relevant. I'll give you a quick story. So I was listening to this patient talk, and this was a patient who talks a lot. He goes on and on and on and on. And I'm listening to him, and I'm listening, and I had this extremely strange kind of, I moved into this state where all I could see was gray with little, like, distant lights. And I thought, am I going crazy? Like, what the fuck is happening here? What's going on? What's happening to me, right? So I interrupted him, and I said to him, you know, I don't know what's happening, but I have to tell you, I'm having this very strange experience while you're talking. I'm like, things have gone gray and all I can see is gray and little lights, and it's not, and I'm in this like fog, it's like a fog descended on me. And he said, my friends say the same thing. It turns out that because he talks nonstop, he has this effect on people. He fogs them out, right? And the more we talked about it, the more we discovered where it came from, which is his father was a doctor. And when my patient was a boy, his father would make the boy stand in front of him, like 9 or 10 years old, and the father would read long articles from medical journals to him. And the boy would fog out. And so somehow he managed in adulthood to find a way to reverse that. So he's the talker because it's better. It was so traumatic for him being in that state. He found a way to reverse it. There's only two roles, the talker and the guy in the fog. And he found a way to be the talker and other people go into the fog. And so, but it's that's where those metaphors come from. They're often visions. As somebody's talking, here's just an image that comes to my mind, and I honor that, and I bring it out, and I talk about it. And that's a lot of where those come from.
You mentioned something with young therapists and how they see very surface level. So, would you suggest someone who's listening to this thinking of getting a therapist to go with someone more experienced, more wiser, more older, or is it not that absolute, maybe young, a good decision, maybe not?
Well, I would say that you want someone with some experience. It's not necessarily older and wiser, although could be, but you want somebody with some experience as a therapist, if you can afford that. If you can't, then, you know, you'll make do with what you have, and hopefully that person will be good. Someone who's more experienced dealing with kind of whatever you're dealing with, and just kind of listens better, and again, you can see coming up with different kinds of questions as opposed to simply like empathizing or agreeing. Empathy is wonderful, but it's only the beginning.
That makes sense.
You want someone who can also challenge you. And the challenge will come from the therapist. It won't come from you. So you want somebody who can do that.
Got it. Okay. This has been really, really amazing, even really helpful for me, just asking these questions. So I wanted to throw a bunch of questions at you. Just rapid fire, first things that come to your mind, just answer, and it's just a fun thing that I like to do. So, favorite books that shape you?
I'll do my best. As you can hear, I tend to like to be thoughtful as opposed to impulsive.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. Anything that comes to your mind, you can throw it out there. So,
all right, go ahead.
Favorite books that changed you?
Ulysses by James Joyce. The Hero's Journey. I mean, which is The Hero with a Thousand Faces. With regard to this, of course, No More Mr. Nice Guy. And Iron John.
Iron John. And who's that by?
Robert Bly.
Robert Bly. Awesome. What are some favorite quotes or mantras that you live by?
Well, I mentioned it before, but I'll give you the full quote. It's from Bob Dylan's song, It's All Right, Ma. And the quote goes, "From the fool's gold mouthpiece, the hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying."
Mm, I like that. And what's one lesson? If you were to be off the face of the planet tomorrow, there's one thing that you can impart on the entire world. One lesson. What would that be?
Feel all your feelings all the time. Don't be afraid of emotions.
That's beautiful. I love it. Well, thank you so much for hopping on. This has been a very great time talking to you. If someone wants to know more about you, know more about your work, or buy your book and actually do the work that's inside of it, then where can they find you?
Okay. My website is www.drparisertherapy.com, and that's spelled DrParisertherapy.com. The book is coming out July 14th. It's going live on Amazon. It'll be a Kindle ebook and a paperback. And I'm pushing to try to get it onto Audible, but I haven't gotten there yet. I am going to be building an online course with ongoing groups based on the Nice Guy Hero's journey, so that one of the things that helps is to not have to do this alone. So that you can, there'll be small group projects, like, you know, kind of, you know, ships with like 10 people in them going off on a quest. And so, I'll do shorter, you know, like master classes and mastermind groups, but this is the one I'm really excited about. It's like a year long, hero's journey that you can sign up for. Like, it's a ticket on the Argo. We're going for the golden fleece.
I like it. What made you decide to live on a boat? Was it a whim decision or something that you decided for a long period of time?
Nah, I was living someplace and it wasn't working out, and that's a long funny story. But I wanted to buy a house. And the real estate prices in Los Angeles were nuts, right? You know, they're just nuts. And I couldn't afford what I wanted. And I always had in the back of my mind, you know, oh, I could always live on a boat, right? But I would think, you know, a boat is this like little narrow thing and it rocks and there's like laundry hanging and you're cooking and this kind of metal kettle on a hot plate and it smells bad and everything's damp and dark and there's no internet. And then a friend of mine invited me to brunch on his boat, and I just took one look at it and went, I could do this. This would work. And the next day I went out and started looking for boats. And a couple of weeks later, I found one that worked, and I've been on it for the last close to 6 years now.
Wow, that's a long time. Do you have any troubles with, like, if the weather's bad?
Well, you know, not very much. Because of the kind of boat it is, it's a twin-engine power boat, right? And so it sits very high off the water. It has a lot of above deck, and that means that it has a lot of what's called windage, which is to say when the wind blows, it tends to rock. So on a normal day, I don't even notice it, but if the wind's really howling, yeah, then much more than rain. It's a boat. It gets wet, right? Everything gets wet. It's all right. But the wind is where it really gets to be a problem. And if I were to take it out in the ocean and the waves were big, then it's now we've got a whole different set of problems. But here in a protected marina, as long as the wind's not blowing too hard, it's great. It's very solid.
Makes sense. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for hopping on. Everyone who's listening to this, go check out Michael Prasser, if I'm saying it right again.
Pariser, Michael Pariser.
Pariser, sorry about that.
And www.drparisertherapy.com and the book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, The Hero's Journey.
And that's coming out July 14th, right?
Exactly.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for hopping on. Appreciate it.
You got it, Mo. My pleasure. Great questions, and thank you very much. It was a lot of fun going back and forth with you.
Yep, it was.